Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Are They Worth It show, and more explained on that as we start the show. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. And for some reason, the man over there is creating all the crowd sounds that you may or may not be able to hear.
It's Dr. Tony Weaver.
From the University of Kentucky, telecommunications guru, the man in charge of the phones, the man in charge of the emails, the man in charge of all the ways that folks at UK communicate with each other, and my good friend and our co-medical host to talk about our web presence, Rick Phillips. Hey, Rick.
Hey, Tony. You know, have you seen the DirecTV commercials with the people on the wires?
Yes.
That's me. Okay. That's me, UK. I'm just a puppet running around there and bouncing all around, spilling lemonade. That's me. And if you want to get more into this show and you want to go back and listen to some audio, go to WMKY.org. That is the radio station's website. They have all the shows there. I keep saying that. I say that every week, and every week I need to correct. We keep the most recent shows. We don't keep them all.
Right.
So if you missed a show, go back. You'll find it in the archives there. Listen to it. Save it. It's MP3. You can burn a CD, put it in your car, listen to us driving down the road, put us on your MP3 player. There's a link there for the podcast. If you know what a podcast is, then you know what to do. It'll deliver somewhere around 2, 3, maybe 4 days at the most from the live airing or the first airing. So again, that's all at WMKY.org. After that, jump over to Facebook. Put a /HM Radio Show on the end of that. So it would be facebook.com/HM Radio Show. That'll get you to our fan page on Facebook. Like it. We'll send you different posts that have research. Some of it's on the show, some of it's not on the show. You can leave feedback. You can leave a show topic request. All kinds of things there. But you can certainly interact with the staff at facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor for today's show, Cancer-Fighting Dietary Factors. This was an interesting article, I thought, that came from the Journal of the American College of Nutrition.
Tony, when do we ever bring articles that aren't interesting?
Well, and I know I'm a bit, what do you call it, a wonk, a nerd? What do you?
You're not even a power geek.
Okay, but whatever I am, I like to read this stuff, and so it's interesting to me. It was released on June 10, the Journal of the American College of Nutrition, and first of all, a little background. American Cancer Society says there will be 1.6 million new cancer cases, over half a million deaths this year. The NIH says the cost of treating cancer, $200 billion a year, 86 in direct medical expenses, 130 in indirect costs due to loss of productivity and premature death. So there was this 537-page document on cancer diets, and I didn't pay any attention to it because it's 537 pages.
Of diets.
I don't have that kind of time. This was published by the World Cancer Research Fund, the American Institute for Cancer Research. But here's what they did. These guys went through the evidence and said, where is the evidence strong enough we can make a strong recommendation? So there are six statements about foods and cancer. Now, this is not foods and longevity. It's not foods and better regularity or anything like that. They're strictly talking about what would you eat or not eat to try to avoid cancer. So if there's a certain type of cancer that runs in your family and it happens there's some strong scientific information on it, it'll be in these six recommendations.
Let's hear them.
All right.
Are we going to get them all at once?
Or no. Heavens no. We're going to go one and two this time.
Are they the good ones?
They're the first two. What, you think they lead off with the good ones? What, they hold the good ones for the end? Maybe they have the best food recommendations at the end because it's like dessert.
Is it going to make me hungry?
No. This will absolutely not make you hungry. As a matter of fact, it will make you depressed. Let's just go ahead and say it. As you might imagine, fun foods are not necessarily healthy foods. That's the problem. Mm. Recommendation number one on dairy products. Limiting or avoiding dairy products may reduce your risk of prostate cancer.
So you're saying give up ice cream?
Well, ice cream, milk,
but don't dairy products. People like ice cream?
Yeah. But now here's the thing, you know, once you get to age 85, all bets are off, eat what you want, you'll be fine. That's Weaver's rule
of diet.
I like
the way you say that.
Yeah.
Can we drop that to 75 so I got something to look forward to?
Once you get, if you get 5 years away from expiring, at that point, live it up. Because you only got 5 years.
So in Kentucky, that would be 71.
The only question is,
right?
Yeah, it would actually. Once you hit your 70s, apparently in Kentucky.
Well, see, I'm closer than we think.
But maybe we can actually push that up a little bit if we wait till the mid-70s anyway.
This crazy bug I've got, I'm about ready for it.
Yes, Rick still is suffering from a virus, but back to the sponsor. Limiting or avoiding dairy products may reduce the risk of prostate cancer. Every 35 grams of dairy protein raises your risk of prostate cancer by about 32%.
35 grams? Is that what you said?
Yeah. So basically,
because I measure my dairy product.
If you have, if you have a pretty heavy family history of prostate cancer and you're putting away milk with every meal and some ice cream with supper, then you are going to get prostate cancer. Fats in the dairy also increase the risk of cardiovascular disease. Now, here's
so skim milk.
Yeah.
So if you're going to do it, do skim.
Here's the disadvantages. You're doing milk. If you limit or avoid milk and dairy products, you may reduce your calcium intake. And if you rely on milk and dairy products as a primary calcium source. Now, that might be for the women, but keep in mind we're talking about prostate cancer, which is a man cancer.
What about gelato?
They don't have any recommendations on
gelato.
Well, I mean, honestly, this is...
I'm just trying to figure out how to get around this ice cream thing.
I know. You want ice cream. I'm saying if there's a risk of prostate cancer in your family history, you need to limit your dairy products. That's a strong recommendation one. And they mentioned you can get your calcium from soy.
Ooh, yeah. Let's do that.
Right. Ladies and gentlemen, you heard it first here on Health Matters. Get your calcium from soy. We all love soy.
So do soy milk, right?
Okay. Recommendation number two. And we have talked about this before, Rick, and I'm going to say it again. Alcohol, limiting or avoiding alcohol may reduce the risk of cancers of the mouth, the pharynx, the larynx, the esophagus, the colon, the rectum, and the breast. One drink per week increases the odds of getting throat cancer by 24%. Two or three per day elevates the risk of colorectal cancer by 21%. And when you think about those baseline odds, the baseline odds of throat cancer are not very high. But the baseline odds of colorectal cancer, it's actually among men and women together, the second most common cause of cancer death.
And drinking only makes that worse.
Yeah. Moderate alcohol use, one drink for women, two drinks for men per day, is associated with a lower risk of cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's disease. And so we don't know what will happen with your cardiovascular disease, especially if there's a family history of colon or rectal cancer. These cancers of the throat, you're going to raise your risk. Now, like I said, if that risk is tiny and you raise it by 24%, no big deal. If it is a very common cancer and you raise it by 21%, that's colorectal cancer, it is a big deal. And in the U.S., the ill effects of alcohol, I mean, even as what we call drinking in moderation, the ill effects of alcohol are really underplayed. Alcohol is tough on your body. It just is, as you might imagine. It just is.
Well, you know, I mean, Tony, if you overindulge in alcohol, you know, obviously you become impaired. And then the next day, you typically don't feel well because of the dehydration effects. That alone are to tell you there's something else going on that's not water.
Yep. Yeah, it is. And the thing is, we talk about responsible drinking as if this is the key almost to longevity. It's fun. There's no harm. There are harms to alcohol. Now, the benefits may outweigh the harm. We're not, you know, this is specifically for prevention of cancer. And you've got to look at the total picture. But alcohol is not a safe and healthy thing to do at any dose.
But there's been many studies that suggest a glass of red wine may actually reduce your risk of cardiovascular problems.
Yes.
But again, how do you weigh levels of risk? That is a very difficult thing to do.
Now, back to the title, are they worth it? And I mentioned in the promotion for the show that's been running earlier in the week, we talk about pets and old people, and in a sense of pets and old people being worth it.
What about co-hosts?
Yeah, co-hosts. Well, if they don't get their voice rehabilitated by next time, all bets are off. What triggered this, actually, was there was a cover for Time magazine June 5th. You may remember this. There is a...
Because I always read Time magazine.
Well, but I think you'll remember this. There was a U.S. soldier, the only prisoner of war of the Afghanistan war, Sergeant Bo Bergdahl, right?
Okay.
And there was a deal made releasing terrorists as a swap for Sergeant Bo Bergdahl. And there is a furor that arose over that because there are some that that claim, apparently with some pretty substantial evidence, that Bo Bergdahl actually deserted, actually walked off his post and was captured. And should we be doing this? And the Time magazine cover says, was he worth it? Now, first of all, I have no information about Bo Bergdahl. I don't know anything about whether or not he was a deserter or not. And that's obviously not the purpose of this show. But I think it is a dangerous thing when we start asking, are they worth it? Was he worth it? For instance, the last thing you want is the firefighters to sit at the fire station debating whether or not your house is worth saving.
They haven't seen my house.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. But you see what I'm saying? I mean, there are certain people.
Hang on a second. All right, I'm serious now.
Okay. There are certain people that are not really allowed the luxury of debating, is it worth it?
Well, yeah, certainly public safety individuals, you're right.
Yeah.
Firemen, police officers, I mean, you know.
Yeah. Now, what's interesting to me about this is I think we're asking the same questions in healthcare. We are trying to figure out how to wrestle down a healthcare system that's completely unsustainable. It's simply, we cannot go on the way we are. We could not go on the way we were before the Affordable Care Act. We cannot continue with this. And so we're trying to figure out, well, who is and what is worth it? So we're going to have to answer some of those questions, but I wanted to bring this up because it's a perfect time using that are they worth it metaphor to talk about it.
I mean, this is probably the heyday of medical ethics, right?
Yeah, it really is. What I'm concerned about is some of this seems to be passing right by us and escaping, as ethical things do. And I think it's time maybe we slow down a little bit. It's summer. Not a lot going on right now. Let's think about the ethics of this. This is a guy named Robert Lazuski. He's president of Health Policy and Strategy Associates. He also blogs at Healthcare Policy and Marketplace Review. Now, this is a guy that my first guess is he leans Republican. So I'm going to read word for word what he wrote on a healthcare blog. And just to throw this out for you, a recent Washington Post article, Health Law Provides a Comfort to Those at Risk, told one side of the Affordable Care Act story. It recounted the relief a number of people had finally be able to buy a health plan because they could no longer be excluded. One fellow was going to have gallbladder surgery as soon as his coverage was effective. Another needs surgery for endometriosis. A woman with high blood pressure and a congenital heart defect signed up as soon as she could. Another lady making $11,000 a year with a health history that put her in debt was able to get Medicaid and be covered for the first time in a decade. Now, at the same time, says Lazuski, there was an article in the Kaiser Health News, A Texan Weighs Obamacare Options, High Deductible Versus Huge Fear. A 43-year-old woman, healthy, spent only $1,500 for minor health care services last year. The best deal she could get on the exchange, $178 a month. Let's round it, $200 a month, plus $5,000 deductible. So, in essence, over the next year, she's going to have to pay $7,400 before she gets first dollar of coverage from her insurance.
Right.
Out of pocket. And she says, look, I don't smoke. I'm relatively healthy. I was pretty insulted by this price. I was angry. I felt hoodwinked by the insurance companies. Here's this wonderful insurance plan. But by the way, you need to come up with $6,000. And I'm calculating $7,400 out of pocket before we pay anything. Now, this is what Lazuski says. He says, Obamacare architects put most of their emphasis on deciding for consumers that they should have a mandated rich health plan. That, in turn, drove the cost up, which drove the deductibles up and narrowed the networks. He says, a private market-driven approach would have, rather than having the insurance company tell you what's good for you, it would ask you what you wanted. What do you really want? And then figure out how to deliver it. In that case, the entrepreneur might have gone to this woman in Texas and asked what she wanted and then formed a health insurance plan that met her needs. Now, this sounds good. Let's hold for our second fractional portion, and I'll explain to you why I think Lazuski is completely, totally wrong. It has nothing to do with politics. It has to do with that question, are they worth it? So tying these things together, we're going to come back in our second fractional portion and talk about more about are they worth it. We'll also talk some about pets and immune response. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio. Please stay tuned for our second fractional portion.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters, and in this segment, we're going to find out if I'm worth it. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Are They Worth It show. This was a rant, a musing that was triggered by the Time magazine cover on Bo Bergdahl, the Afghanistan
was about me.
Prisoner of war. And they said, was he worth the swap and the efforts that they made to try to rescue him? And it made me start thinking about who's worth what, really, in society. Our sponsor for the second time, the Dietary Changes to Reduce Cancer Risk. And again, we talked about recommendations 1 and 2 out of 6 in our first fractional portion. Recommendation number 1, limit or avoid dairy products to reduce your risk of prostate cancer. Recommendation number 2, alcohol. If you limit or avoid alcohol, that may reduce the risk of cancers of the mouth, the pharynx, the larynx, the esophagus, the colon, the rectum, and the breast. That is, alcohol is not an innocuous product, even if you drink, as they say, responsibly. And it gets worse from there, Rick. Recommendation number 3 is on red meat and processed meats. Avoiding red meat and avoiding processed meat may reduce your risk of cancer of the colon and rectum.
What if you cook the meat till it's not red anymore?
Well, that's recommendation number 4, actually.
I can't win with you, Tony.
Yeah, I know. Every 50 grams of meat consumed, red meat consumed per day, boosts your risk of colon and rectal cancers by 21%. Red meat is a source of protein, iron, zinc, meaning that an intake reduction should be correlated with plant-based alternatives. That is, it's a great source of a lot of good stuff. It's also an unfortunate source of a lot of bad stuff. Now, specifically for Rick, number 4, and this one kind of caught me off guard.
Avoid, like Rick normally does,
grilled, fried, or broiled meats. to reduce your risk of cancer of the colon, rectum, breast, prostate, kidney, and pancreas. Meat refers to red meat, to poultry, or to fish. If you grill it, fry it, or broil it, you release heterocyclic amines and polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, and they can increase your risk of cancer. And as the temperature goes up, that is, as you go over flame, you sear it, you blacken it, those temperatures go up. So it's not clear to me, if you grill it, but you don't have a high flame or a high temperature, that may be okay. But a blackened, high-temperature grilling, frying, broiling meats increases your risk of cancer of the colon, rectum, breast, prostate, kidney, and pancreas. There's really no disadvantages to avoiding meats cooked at high temperatures.
I don't even know where to go with that. I mean, you got me in just reeling.
Well, is this...
I mean, I'm a red meat guy, you know. I like a good, you know...
Are you a blackened meat guy? I don't understand
I'm
blackening.
I'm really not that. Now, when I was in Louisiana, they blackened everything. And really, blackened in Louisiana wasn't necessarily that you hit it on the grill and blackened it with the grill, but you basically put a bed of spices on it, and then you heated it up and got the spices to kind of turn color.
Okay.
So it wasn't actually the meat. Wasn't burned or anything like or charred. It was really more of the seasoning that you used to blacken it. And
okay.
It was very spicy.
Okay.
Like when I was in Louisiana, blackened redfish was, I mean, everybody, that was the best meal on a menu that you could go in and get. Now, at some point, they outlawed fishing for redfish. And so then it became non-existent. I think now they're back legal again. So
that's our sponsor, Dietary Changes to Reduce Your Cancer Risk. And we'll come up with our last two recommendations in our third and final fractional portion.
It's not going to be bad for me, is it?
It's going to be rough.
Thanks.
It just is.
Gee, thanks.
Here's a hint. It involves soy protein.
Oh, then I'm fine.
Yeah, you're good. You love the soy protein. No, it's not soy protein being bad. Unfortunately, it's soy protein being the answer to most of your dietary questions.
So Tony, we were pondering the age-old question, is he worth it?
And was he worth it? Again, about Bo Bergdahl, but I'm looking more at a different slant on this. And I'll just remind you, Robert Lazowski posted a blog on, and he writes at Healthcare Policy and Marketplace Review. And he says, look, Obamacare was set up to provide insurance to people who couldn't afford it, people who were unable to get it before. But what about the people who could and suddenly find their insurance rates higher? And again, he mentioned a 43-year-old woman only spent about $1,500 for health care. Between her premiums and deductible, she was going to have to spend $7,400 or over $6,000 anyway before she got any benefit at all from her insurance. He said they should have taken a market-driven approach. Instead of telling consumers what they would want, they should figure out what the people want and then find a way to deliver it. Now, here's the problem. With a market-driven approach, it is true that that woman in Texas certainly could have gotten her insurance for less. The whole idea of the Affordable Care Act was to extend insurance to people who were unable to afford it. Now, in order to extend insurance, somebody's got to pay more for the product. Maybe we should have a national discussion on this, but the problem with the market-driven approach, trying to get her the cheapest product possible, is that means that she is not assisting those who were unable to get their insurance.
So what you're saying is basically our Affordable Care Act or our health care system now is mimicking our tax system.
Right. And the question then becomes, are sick people worth it? That's really the question. Do people who don't have much money, people who have chronic illnesses, are they worth paying extra for health insurance? Now, we've gotten to the point where we sort of jettison anything that keeps us from getting the best deal for ourselves. That is, it doesn't matter where the shirt was made. If it's cheaper than the other shirts, I'll buy it. It doesn't matter what type of labor it was made with. We don't care about that. We look for the best deal. And in marketplace terms, that's actually supposed to be good. Overall, everybody benefits if we all look for the best deal, and we should not have these false allegiances to a certain country's economy or to a certain type of worker or anything like that. I actually have a problem with it. And I think the other thing that bothers me that I think we get wrong is we decide that some people, in fact, aren't worth it. For instance, a guy who rides a motorcycle without a helmet. Now, I think that's stupid. I do. But there is an idea that...
No, wait, stop. What's stupid? The guy not wearing the helmet or how we treat the guy not wearing the helmet?
Well, I think the guy is being stupid by not wearing a helmet because
right.
Helmets would actually protect him if he were in a wreck.
And I've always said I don't care if he wears a helmet or not, but if he chooses not to wear a helmet, I shouldn't have to pay his medical bills.
All right, now there you go, Rick. See, that's the fallacy I'm talking about. These guys that don't wear a helmet, some of them wind up costing you a lot.
Absolutely.
But a lot of them... die.
Right.
Don't cost you anything. You know who costs you? the guy that lives to be 100 years old.
Sure. And I mean, same thing we were going through with lung cancer. We're getting rid of smoking, but lung cancer, when 28% of the people were dying at an early age, was actually cheaper.
Yeah. Here's the two fallacies to realize. One is preventive care does not save money, except with kids. If you do preventive care on babies, then you prevent lifelong diseases. But when you get to my age, all you're doing is prolonging my retirement, making me live longer, which is going to sop up more money. Now, I think that's a good thing.
Absolutely. From my vantage point.
But you see, and I understand what I meant was from
our own points of view, that's what we want.
Right.
When society as a whole starts trying to make policy towards you and I, that's where the is he worth it question comes in and the medical ethics creep into the discussion.
That's absolutely right. A person who is fanatical about taking care of his health is actually going to be more of a drain on society because he's going to spend more dollars over his longer lifespan than the motorcycle guy without a helmet. This was the unspoken word with cigarette smokers is they saved our Social Security, our retirement system, by dying early and not taking benefits.
Right.
And so when you start talking about are people worth it, what you've got to realize is everything you thought really gets turned on its edge. The truth of the matter is the people that cost the most money are the people that live the longest. I'm still okay with that, but I think when we go forward, deciding that certain people are not worth it because of their behaviors is wrong.
Well, I mean, what point, Tony, will we put a value or a dollar benefit on diabetic patient?
Yeah.
I mean, at some point, we're going to monetize that person. Well, and it's a shame. I mean, I see where you're going. I mean, as soon as we start putting a value to a disease, next thing you know, the disease gets attached to a person. Now, all of a sudden, by simple math, the dollar amount is attached to the person.
Right.
And we're getting into this whole weighting system as what is this particular treatment worth the $86,000 cancer treatment? Some of the cancer treatments are very, very expensive.
Yeah. And what I'm going to say is, you know, I don't think we don't have the ability to say, oh, this person's not worth it, they're going to die. We will say is, I can't afford my insurance. And my insurance just happens to pay for this guy's health care, but I can't afford it. So this is a me decision. It's nothing about this guy. And that's the thing about the Affordable Care Act. We're all in this together. We really need to come up with a strategic solution to all these healthcare problems together. But if we just simply say, I expect a cheaper healthcare plan, I don't want to pay this, then somebody gets cut off. And you got to realize that when you're thinking about this thing ethically. And so that's what really brought it home to me. I think whether it is a person who is out there, a prisoner of war, he did something stupid, I don't know. That's not my decision. But the decision to abandon an American, the decision to abandon a sick person, the decision to abandon a burning building, to close down a hospital, all these things, when you ask, are they worth it, you're on a very, very dangerous area to start figuring out who's worth it and who's not.
Isn't your oath, your medical oath basically is, if somebody's in front of you and they're sick, you kind of took an oath to take care of them regardless of all that other stuff, right?
Well, interestingly enough, that's what we thought, but to be honest, right now, there are those ethicists who feel that I have to protect the healthcare system. That is, by avoiding what they would consider wasteful spending. And again, everybody decides what wasteful spending is differently.
Yeah, but I mean, that's impossible when for instance, you being basically a rural physician for, your entire adult life, and you've had patients that you've been with you for 30 years, now they're 85, they need a treatment. Where's the ethics in that? You know, they've been your friend. I just think they can't put that decision in your hands, Tony.
Well, I've also got to answer to their families after they're gone.
Absolutely.
And let me just say, right now, I'll tell you, I ran into contact with a family member. I'm going to try to be as broad as possible so as not to identify any individual people. Their grandfather was at one hospital. This man is critically ill, probably a very short period of time left. And the one hospital said, look, he's an elderly person. He's critically ill. You need to come to grip with reality. He's going to die. We're going to make him comfortable. They did not. They took him to a different hospital. That hospital did some procedures. Those procedures made him feel better, but will probably not extend into his lifespan any at all.
Right.
So which hospital did right? The one that tried to convince the family that, in fact, he had a very short period of time left and we need to ramp down our procedures? Or the one that did the procedure they wanted, made the family satisfied, even though it won't have any effect on his life expectancy? Those decisions go on every day at hospitals, and there is very, very little guidance to decide who's worth it and what we ought to be doing, especially with our elderly patients.
Tony, it's a tough, tough situation. I mean, again, I think, the whole idea, I do find it intriguing that if you step away from healthcare and you look at the tax system, the thing about the tax system is is there are people at every level of income that support the tax system. So the federal government operates based on what both people who have lots of money and people who have almost no money. In healthcare, you're trying to distribute the cost of healthcare against a group that's missing. There's a group missing from them, and that's the uber wealthy. You know, they don't put in their 3% or 28% or whatever it is to help the system. You know, so I think frankly, this is a tough thing. And, yeah. And asking, you know, and I feel bad for this woman who, you know, was paying very little, you know, maybe $1,500 a year, and now all of a sudden she's going to have to come out of pocket close to $7,000 just to get the first dollar of care. I mean, that's tough, but you're right. There's an ethics thing of, do you not pay it? Do you pay it? I mean, what's the damage?
Right. And I'm not here to tell you the answer. I'm
just
saying
I don't know either.
We need to discuss this. This is not something that really we're talking much
about.
But
it is interesting how the whole medical ethics thing has crept into every area now. I mean, now it's actually in the whole, even socialized care. I mean, you know, it was one thing when it was the 85-year-old patient, you know, going between hospitals or, you know, turning off, not adding an extra surgery, you know, for something that they have a low prognosis for. You know, those are ethics questions we've dealt with for years and years and years. This is a whole new set of ethics questions that comes into play.
Yeah. It will become progressively harder for people to go without insurance. I mean, right now there's a minor tax penalty. If you don't get a refund, you don't get penalized at all. But what I'm seeing is hospitals and healthcare organizations are starting to tighten their approach toward people who have no insurance. They cannot afford to continue to give away care under our new system, and it is going to be very hard to go without insurance. You're not going to get the care you need, and there's going to be less charity available because everyone's supposed to get help getting your insurance. We're going to switch gears completely. It's time to talk about something a little less heavy. That's right. This came actually from a service called Medscape Medical News out of Minneapolis. This is Sleep 2014. It's the 28th annual meeting of the Associated Professional Sleep Societies.
Was their keynote session
a
snoring?
But this is pretty interesting. This is, I can't even say the name. It looks like Duthuluru is the last name from University of Kansas Medical Center in Kansas City. They looked at 298 consecutive adults in the waiting room of a family practice clinic. They had them do a survey about their pets and sleep quality. Of the 148 pet owners.
My pet sleeps good.
Of the 148 pet owners, nearly one-third reported being awakened at least once a night by their pet. So your pet sleeps well. It does not wake you up.
Oh, no. I didn't say that. I was making a joke.
Okay.
Because I know exactly how I don't know how my dog sleeps. But no, you're right. My dog does. You know, the thing is, the dog doesn't wake me up in the middle of the night. The dog gets me up early in the morning to be taken out.
They mentioned more than half the pet owners said they shared their bed or bedroom with a dog. That's 58%. A cat, 42%. 57% admitted to sharing their bed with the dog. 57% of these pet owners in this family practice clinic waiting room admitted they shared a bed with a dog. Three-quarters shared the bed with a single pet. One-quarter had two pets in the bed with them. Most said they slept one night per week with their pet in the bed. I don't understand that. 8% did four or more nights per week. And these people had a very poor sleep quality with all these dogs rolling around in the bed with them.
Really?
Yeah. Who would have guessed that?
Well, Tony, I mean, you know, mine is a 4.5-pound Yorkie. I mean, you know.
But let me say, you know yourself, a 4.5-pound Yorkie can wake you up pretty darn well if they get started.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Among all pet owners, 5% reported difficulty maintaining sleep or having trouble falling asleep after they have been awakened by their pets. So, again, Dr. Duthuluru said recommended you ask about pet ownership if a person is having difficulty in sleeping.
Do you have any indoor dogs now?
I do not. We have no indoor pets whatsoever. I mean, obviously, if something...
Francis has you.
Yeah. And I do interfere with sleeping. I know that for a fact. But she somehow puts up with it. But you can imagine if we introduce a dog into the bedroom, it's going to wake both of us up. So all of a sudden, you got this three-way dynamic going where everybody's waking everybody up. And I don't go back to sleep very well at all once I wake up. No, I'm
See, as I've
that.
Gotten older, I can go to sleep in like... 18 seconds.
I tell you, it comes and goes. There, I was sleeping well for a while, and now I'm back to not sleeping well. I don't know, you know, what's different. I try to notice behaviors, but I'm not doing well right now. Now, here's the second, same study, the Sleep Society's group. This is Mayo Clinic Center for Sleep Medicine in Phoenix. They surveyed 110 patients about their pets as a part of a comprehensive sleep questionnaire. 46% of the patients had pets. 42% had more than one pet. Dogs, cats, and birds. One household had 5 dogs and a cat. They think that's amazing. 10% of pet owners reported being annoyed that their pets sometimes disturb their sleep by wandering, snoring, whimpering, or needing to go outside during the night. One person had the parrot and said it squawked every morning at 6 a.m. Sleep specialist,
that's
they said,
called a rooster. It's not a parrot. That's a rooster.
Here's Dr. Christopher Winter. He's the medical director of the Martha Jefferson Hospital Sleep Medicine Center in Charlottesville, Virginia. He was at the meeting. He said, from my perspective, patients will often say, I have this old dog that snores and has to go to the bathroom every 15 minutes. What should I do? And my first thought, says Dr. Christopher Winter, medical director of Martha Jefferson Hospital Sleep Medicine Center in Charlottesville, Virginia, my first thought is, get rid of the dog.
Well, put the dog out.
No, I got to say, but, you know, it's an old dog. It's, you know, you've been with these dogs. I have had people, asthmatics. I've had people with all sorts of problems, and we all we can do is say, well, can you keep it in the other room or something? Because they cannot get rid of their pets.
Well, I mean, Tony, come on. I mean, pets, I mean, there are people who don't understand. There are people who do understand. You know, I don't know which category people are in, but, you know, I mean, when I lost my yellow lab, I felt like I'd lost, you know, I mean, it was very, very difficult. I mean, I'd grown very close to that. You know, animals, again, people disagree, but you can get very attached, very, very attached.
Back to Dr. Winter, pets should not be a bed partner. We don't want kids sleeping in our beds, but for some reason we think pets are different. They are not. Pets are probably worse than kids in a lot of ways. Amen to that.
I don't know. I think you should go back to sleeping. Pets are good to have around. Now, granted, they shouldn't be waking you up at all times of the night.
Yeah. Our third and final fractional portion, we'll return to pets and ask, are pets worth it? We've got some positive news on pets. But first, this interlude from our Health Matters dance troupe. Please enjoy this and come back for our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. Additional information on the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center is available at 606-783-6506 or online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second. Whoa, scratch that. This is the third. See what you did, Tony? You lulled me in.
The hypnotic rhythms of the Health Matters dancers just lulled Rick to sleep.
So I ask you this, am I worth it?
Now you messed me up because you did such a bad job introducing this segment.
I thought that was pretty cool. I thought that was pretty cool because really now everybody knows I'm not worth it.
Back on track. I am Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Are They Worth It show. The original question came out of Time Magazine. Was this soldier worth the prisoner swap and the efforts made to rescue him? We asked the same question about people who were uninsured, people who are older. How are we going to get our health care expenditures down? Because we seem to have difficulty. And I even gave an example. We talk about reducing expenditures in the last 6 months of life, but there was a family desperate to get help for their grandfather and wound up spending a substantial sum of money to provide him with comfort, even though he had a very short period of time left. Where are we going to draw the line? What are we going to do? And who's worth it and who's not?
Right here.
That is a long explanation of this show, but we're talking this fractional portion about pets. But first, for the final time, our sponsor, Diet to Prevent Cancer, these 6 tips. There was a 537-page document on cancer and dietary factors published by the World Cancer Research Fund.
Do you really think people cared about those last 20 pages?
Yeah.
537 pages.
Well, it's obviously a comprehensive summary. What's neat is this
a comprehensive summary.
Yeah. Okay, that's...
Come on, really?
Do you like that? A comprehensive summary.
537-page
I'm not sure you can...
Comprehensive summary.
That's like Jamal McGlory. You remember that? Spurts of consistency?
Right.
A comprehensive summary is sort of like a spurt of consistency.
Yeah, is that like military intelligence?
Yeah, I think so. These 6 recommendations came from the 537-page document. These are the ones that we feel the most sure about. Now, admittedly, dietary recommendations have had a checkered history. So these researchers said, look, we're not going to mess around with ifs and possibilities. We're going to say these are the strongest recommendations we can make in 2014. And here they are. Recommendation number 5. Here's
Pot
Rick's favorite.
All.
Consumption of soy products during adolescence may reduce the risk of breast cancer in adulthood.
You know, the only thing that I can say is, I'll miss soy sauce.
Yeah, well, I'm just thinking there, Rick, you probably are thinking, I'll take my chances with breast cancer. I don't want to eat soy.
Have you seen me, Tony? I'm not even going to joke like that.
Soy products may also reduce the risk and recurrence of mortality for women previously treated for breast cancer, so soy products are a pretty nice thing for the women. We men are naturally more skeptical. Soy foods are encouraged for women who want to significantly reduce their risk of breast cancer, also recommended as a healthy source of calcium and protein for both genders. Well, that's what they say. I'm not going to make
more
a sarcastic
soy,
comment.
More soy, huh?
That's right. Disadvantages, when used in large amounts, soy protein concentrates and isolates have been shown to increase insulin-like growth factor, suggesting that they should be traditional soy foods should be favored over soy protein concentrates.
So what is a soy food? Are we talking about soy beans? I mean, soy sauce seems like it's all salt.
Right.
What are we talking here? Do you know?
Do you think I have an encyclopedic knowledge of the various soy products out there?
Of all the people I know, you're the one to ask.
No. We got to get the dietitians in here. I have not a clue. As a matter of fact, if you know, please drop us a line on our Facebook
page.
Here's
the deal. Tell best us, soy product on the website.
That's right. Tell us what
the best
favorite
soy
product is, and we'll put it on the air. We'll mention your name, or if you want to remain anonymous.
We'll do the top 11 list.
Now, recommendation number 6, I think you can handle this. Emphasizing fruits and vegetables in your diet will likely reduce the risk of several common forms of cancer.
Why couldn't that be number 1?
Broccoli, kale, and cabbage associated with an 18% reduced risk of colorectal, lung, and stomach cancers. A diet high in tomatoes is associated with a 27% risk reduction in the risk of gastric
Does
or stomach
spaghetti
cancers.
Spaghetti sauce count?
I don't know. Actually, yes. You know, when you look at the stuff that's in tomatoes, those tomato sauces, properly done, those are pretty darn good for you. Nothing wrong with tomato sauces. They actually may be a little bit more concentrated than the raw tomatoes in the lycopenes.
Well, now we're getting somewhere, Tony.
Okay.
Finally.
So finally we figure if we got this spaghetti sauce or we get tomato sauce on our pizzas and so forth, and then, I don't know, whatever that soy stuff, whatever. You know, and then
I'm going to put soy sauce on my pizza. There we go. Right there.
So you got to go spaghetti sauce on one side, soy sauce on the other side, and you got your pizza. And the other thing about fruits and vegetables, which is kind of nice, they also lower your risk of heart disease, which cancer and heart disease are two most common causes of death. So you might actually live to normal life expectancy, even here in Kentucky, if you eat your fruits and vegetables.
You know what's funny is you know, fruits specifically, you know, when I was a kid, I wasn't a big fruit eater. You know, I didn't like it. But, you know, I find as I grow older, I find fruit more desirable. I don't really know why that is, but it's a really good form of, you know, it helps the sweet tooth, but it's also, I don't know, it just makes you feel good.
Yep. Remember, not fruit juices, but actual fruits. That's the way to go. Now, let's go back to our original theme of are they worth it? We talked last time rather disparagingly about dogs and cats.
Yep.
Particularly the recommendation you do not sleep with a dog or a cat because they are likely to disturb your sleep and more likely to give you problems with insomnia and things like that. We looked at patients both in a family medicine clinic who filled out a questionnaire and also patients in a sleep clinic discussed their pet. Many of them who were having sleep problems actually had an animal sleeping in the bed with them. Now, the good stuff. This was actually from the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, the June issue. Urban newborns who share their homes with cockroaches, mice, and cats might get the same protection from allergies and asthma that the farm kids get. First of all, we've known for a long time that exposure, early exposure to farm animals to these type of allergens is associated with a lower risk of allergic diseases. The worst thing you can do for your baby is to try to keep them in a sterile environment. Oddly enough.
They need some of that bacteria. Huh?
Right. Yeah, I mean, you got to have some sense about it. You don't want people sneezing on them. You don't want people who are have an acute illness to handle them. But as far as the kids getting dirty, there is nothing wrong with a baby getting dirty.
Nice.
Yeah. So this hygiene hypothesis, the idea that allergies may be increasing because children grow up in sterile environments, maybe we should do something about that. Up until now, actually the urban data argued against it. It turns out that low-income urban children who lived around cockroaches, mice, and so forth had a higher risk of allergies. The problem is those low-income children also were exposed to cigarette smoke and higher pollution levels. So we couldn't tell whether or not the exposure to bacteria and dirt was helping them out. So this is a new study published in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology in June. 467 children. They had the same increased risk overall, but those exposed to mouse and cat dander, cockroach droppings, and certain bacteria before age 1 seemed to benefit with lower risk of allergies or asthma symptoms by age 3.
Now, Tony, I mean, somebody's going to have to get a thesaurus out here and reword this thing, because if you tell a mother who just delivered a baby, okay, you got to get your kid near this stuff, they're going to smack you.
Yeah. Now, here's
and, you know, you're probably going to deserve it.
All right. Here's the thing. They were looking at house dust samples in these kids' houses, and they found that the dirt that was rich in bacteria and animal dander, 41% of the infants who made it to three without allergies, 7% of those who had allergies before age three. Now, it doesn't show that the bacteria or the animal dander made the difference, but it's the very first study to actually show that what we're seeing in farm families seems to apply to urban kids as well. If the environment is too clean for the baby, you've got a problem. Clifford Bassett, New York City allergist, says this does not, the message is don't over-sanitize. I'm not saying you need to get a cat for your baby, and dogs in this particular study didn't seem to help. But he said 20 years ago, we told people to remove pets from their home to prevent allergies. We know that's wrong. If your child has an allergy, well, all bets are off. You're going to have to try to limit their stimulation from animal danders and so forth. But early in life, if they get exposed to these things, that's a pretty good thing. Now, this study doesn't say how to do it. Like you said, do you grow cockroaches? Of course not. What about doing...
Where do I get that dander you're talking about?
Yeah, yeah, well, you know...
The fairy dust. The pixie dust.
The stuff that... Well, first of all, if you have a dog, you know where the... you can find it pretty
Take
much...
Take a gander at the dander.
That's
it's
right.
over
just,
there.
It's on your couch. It's pretty much wherever that dog sits. You can just see piles of dog hair and so forth.
I do think this is interesting, though, Tony. And the question that I would have just off the top of my head is, you know... When does a person become, and I don't want to label them, but I kind of can't help it. When does a person become a germaphobe? You know, when do they get to the point where they're so clean that, I mean, that they take all those steps to get rid of that? And then, and how do we get to that person beforehand, or how do we get to people at the right age here to let them know that it's okay to have some of this environment around you? You don't have to over-sanitize. I like how he said, don't over-sanitize your world.
I don't know.
I mean, we
you
want
know,
clean hands.
Right.
I mean, we know that.
And
wash your hands.
And you don't want roaches around your house. But I think the idea of allowing your children to play with... Well, let me give you some practical advice. This was 4th of June, and I forgot where I got this, to be honest.
Well, you know, yeah, I can see that when we were kids, we played outside in the dirt with the, you know... I mean, so yeah, I was probably exposed to a lot more than my kids were.
Right. This was a lecture from Professor Graham Rook, who's microbiology and immunology at University College London. He says... Pick the food up off the floor.
5-second rule.
Yeah.
We can extend it to 10 seconds
You can
now.
Go 10 seconds. Having a dog or having pets around and regularly kissing your relatives are some of the best ways to ward off allergies.
Come here, Grandma.
Put those teeth back in, Grandma, and give me a big one. Because honestly, you know, but we've become so obsessed with cleanliness that we don't come in contact with these germs. So here's what he said. This was the Cheltenham Science Festival in Great Britain. It's a generational problem. With children of Western nations, they're more susceptible to allergies than older people. Asthma, hay fever, food intolerances are on the rise. Allergic reactions jumped 8% in Great Britain, following a steady increase over the past three decades. And he says the problem is your immune system is trained to protect you. If you do not do something with your immune system, it starts to attack dust, pollen, and it starts to actually attack itself.
So what you're saying is it's very much like me trying to learn how to run a mile.
Right.
My body has to train regularly so that when it comes time to run the mile, I can. You're saying when there's things around for my immune system to do, it's like exercising it.
Simple way to keep the immune system working well, pass germs between family members. I know that sounds odd. He says one of the things is you don't rush to sterilize the pacifier. He calls it the dummy when the baby spits it out. If you pick it up right away and sterilize it or replace it with a new one, your child has a higher risk of developing eczema and asthma and other allergies.
So Tony, let me get on but off track just a little bit. I do listen to morning sports radio, okay?
Right.
And there's a particular sports announcer who loves the idea of getting rid of the male handshake, or I guess male-female, but the greeting of a handshake, because they feel like it spreads bacteria, spreads germs. You're basically saying, nah, it's okay. The handshake is not going to kill us. It's going to make us stronger.
Right. It's not good enough. You ought to kiss each other. It's the thing. No.
So in Ethiopia, where they do the double kiss, they're really immune.
Well, you know, during times of infection, during times of influenza, you've got to make a change.
And, correct.
And we're talking about now going to the fist bump. And you know my feelings about getting doing a handshake at a meal.
Right.
You're
meals
sitting at
aren't
the table.
The place.
Yeah. And you're actually starting to eat your meal. A new guy comes to sit down with you. I do not want to shake their hands and touch my food immediately. But the idea of contact between people is not bad.
So what you're saying is it's okay to have some bacteria, but we don't want to take a needle and inject it straight into our blood supply.
Right.
So there's a time for it and there's a time against it.
Right. And I will tell you, you know, my daughter mentioned this to me. I had not heard this, but here it is on paper as well. If a parent actually picks up the baby's pacifier, sucks it clean, and then sticks it back in the baby's mouth, exchanges germs, that benefits the baby's immune system. Now, she had heard that instead of wiping with the sterilized wipes and things, just suck the dirt off the pacifier, give it back to the baby with your germs on it, that actually benefits the baby.
Don't in Alaska, I think I was reading this, so it might be an Eskimo thing, that a lot of times the mother will actually chew the baby's food for them and then give it to them. I bet you the same thing happens there. I bet you're transmitting bacteria that the child can adapt to.
Dr. Graham Rook again. Don't be fussy if food falls on the floor, walks in the country, kissing, all good ways. Antibacterial soaps are a bad idea. Let me say that again.
If you're going to kiss, make sure you have permission.
Fair enough. That's good physical training, too, getting slapped around, but still. Antibacterial soaps are a bad idea, he said. Now, we spend so much time talking about towels and cleaning up in the bathroom.
Yeah, I think there's a time and place.
It's an interesting thing. I agree. He says, if your immune system is not needed, it doesn't shut down. It does something pointless, like attacking grass pollen or attacking the neighbor's cat when it walks past, and then you're going to have allergy problems. He says, you really need to keep your immune system finely tuned.
So, Tony, what you're saying is I don't really have a lot of allergies. So you're saying I've lived just a dirty enough life.
Rick, on the cusp of filth, which has worked out well for you.
It's worked out well.
I got to say, you're doing okay on that.
Apparently, whatever I did, I didn't suppress the shellfish and... Anyway,
all right, time running down. So pets may be worth it then. And again, he recommends having a dog. Dogs and cat ownership, especially young children being around dogs and cats, and early is really important in this. You do not want to take a child from a sterile environment to something like this because it really overloads their immune system. But you really need to bring your child up in a world where there are germs so that they can learn to live in that world.
Side note, you know, pets are proven to extend the age of a person by companionship. So, I mean, there's all kinds of pet benefits.
Fair enough. I've got 4 medication safety tips for older people from the FDA.
20 seconds each.
20 seconds each. FDA press announcement, June 6th. Take your medicine as prescribed. The thing you've got to realize is even if you don't like the way it works, if you go and invent your own regimen, I'll take it every other day, I'll take it when the moon is full, those type of things. If you don't know how this medicine works in the first place, you might be taking it in such a way that it's ineffective. That's common sense. The second one I really like, we've said this before on Health Matters, keep a medication list. Write down what you're taking. Keep the list with you. Give a copy to a friend or someone you trust, especially in case of emergency. Have the medicine's name, the dosage, and how often you take it. And finally, note when you take each drug during the daytime. You should know your medicines better than the doctor does, says the FDA. Third, beware of potential interactions. One drug may affect another. Milk or alcohol has an effect with drugs. Be aware of the fact that when you do something different may happen. And then finally, review at least once a year. Review all your medications, prescription and non-prescription, with your healthcare provider. Rick, I've got 10 seconds. Let me just let people know. European Medicines Agency in 2012 approved Cialis. It was approved by the FDA in 2003. It's been approved in more than 120 countries, 2 billion plus worldwide sales, 45 million men worldwide treated with it. The manufacturer of Cialis struck a deal with another drug maker to sell an over-the-counter version of the erectile dysfunction pill if federal regulators approve. If that happened, it would hit the markets in 2017 when the patent expires. The first potential over-the-counter erectile dysfunction drug may be for sale in the next 3 years somewhere near you. Can you get us out of here?
Special thanks to Morehead State Public Radio producer Spencer Johnson and to Eric Brilbury, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast DAHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember,
talking with your partner about health matters may not be easy, but it can be helpful for both of you. If you and your partner avoid the conversation, neither of you can know what the other is thinking or feeling. For many men, health matters is tolerable.
You should be open and honest, as well as sensitive about your partner's needs and questions. Remember to stick to the facts and try to think and talk about health matters as the medical problem that it is. That way, you'll both gain a better understanding of what you're going through and what to expect as a couple.
You may want to reassure your partner that health matters is not her fault and that your condition may be caused by another medical issue.
Uncommon side effects of health matters include an idea that won't go away. If you get this idea and it lasts more than 4 hours, get medical help right away. This must be treated as soon as possible or lasting damage can happen to your brain, which includes the inability to have ideas.
Ooh, color vision changes such as seeing a blue tinge to objects or having difficulty telling the difference between the colors blue and green.
Blue and green, always a problem. In rare instances, men listening to MSPR shows reported a sudden decrease or loss of vision in one or both eyes. It is not possible to determine whether or not these events are related to our shows, but other factors such as high blood pressure or diabetes, or to a combination. If you experience a sudden decrease or loss of vision, stop listening and call a healthcare provider right away.
Sudden loss or decrease in hearing, sometimes with ringing in the ears.
Okay, just messing with you. Whatever you do, do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for our exciting series on the health benefits of procrastination on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, hosted by the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information available online at neahec.org.